श्री चैतन्य मनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूप कदामयहं ददाति स्वपदांतिकम्। हरे कृष्णा, वेलकम टू द लास्ट बुक विद इन आवर भक्तिशास्त्री कोर्स। वी आर नाउ डिस्कसिंग द नेक्टर ऑफ डिवोशन। सो द नेक्टर ऑफ डिवोशन इज श्रील प्रभुपाद्स इंग्लिश रेंडिशन of the title of Rupa Goswami's masterpiece called as Bhakti Rasamrut Sindhu. So Bhakti is devotion, Rasa is mellow or flavor or ras, actually there's no equivalent translation literally. Amrut is nectar. So Sindhu is sea or ocean. So it can, if a literal translation would go, it would be the nectarian ocean of the rasa of bhakti. So that becomes a complicated translation if we put in the point that rasa cannot be exactly translated into English. So the word rasa, we will discuss it later more in detail when we come to it. But in general, most people, when they know Hindi or other vernacular languages, the word rasa is generally used to refer to something like amras or gannaras, the juice of mango or juice of sugarcane. But the way Srila Prabhupada uses it and the way Rupa Goswami uses it and the way the rasa shastras use it is something different. It's not a taste in the, like the juice coming out of a particular object which is called as rasa, but it is actually a sweet emotion. It is an emotion basically. Not all rasas are sweet, but it is an emotion. So we will discuss about rasa more in detail. So Srila Prabhupada translates Bhakti Rasamrut Sindhu as Nectar of Devotion. And this is a large book, and in the Bhakti Shastri we won't be covering the full book. We'll be focusing on the first part, that is the 19 chapters. And these 19 chapters will give us a overview of sadhana bhakti, and then raganuga bhakti. So of the, actually there are three stages of bhakti. There is devotion in practice, which is said to be sadhana bhakti, and then there is devotion in ecstasy, Prabhupada translated, that is bhava bhakti, and then there is prema bhakti. So we will discuss these three categories of bhakti in the first 19 chapters, and that is what we will be primarily focusing on. So let us look at the preface. Now, generally when books start, they can have multiple introductory write-ups. So one word for the introductory write-up can be simply introduction, others can be, another can be preface, another is foreword, sometimes there is prologue. So these are all different in slight technical terms. So foreword is generally written by somebody else apart from the author. So the foreword is generally written by a person who is more likely to be familiar to the audience. And then they, just like when a person is giving a class, at that time some other person comes and introduces the speaker to the audience. So generally the introducer is familiar to the audience, and then the introducer acts as a bridge between the speaker and the audience, at least starting off while introducing. So foreword is like that. Foreword is written by somebody else apart from the speaker, apart from the author of the book. So when Srila Prabhupada first published his Bhagavad Gita as it is, it was he did not publish it. ISKCON was too new at that time to have its own press, so Macmillan published it. So at that time there was a foreword written by Allen Ginsberg. Just like in Krishna book, we have a foreword written by George Harrison. So of course Srila Prabhupada later on felt that, because Allen Ginsberg was a hippie leader and he was quite a controversial person who would advocate taking of drugs for spiritual realization. Prabhupada eventually, when ISKCON Press, that later on began BBT, published the Bhagavad Gita as it is, they decided to remove that foreword. But Prabhupada kept George Harrison's foreword in Krishna book. And so George Harrison is a phenomenally famous person during his times at least. And he acted as a bridge between Srila Prabhupada and his Krishna book and the audience. So that is a foreword. So the Lecture of Devotion does not have a foreword. So there's a preface, there is an introduction, and as I said, generally prologue, if it is there, it is generally for novels. So it describes one brief scene from a novel, something which is captivating or something which creates the setting of which the later action unfolds, from where the later action unfolds. So that is the prologue. So here we don't have a prologue, we have preface and introduction. So generally these are phrased in different ways. So Srila Prabhupada, in the preface of the Bhagavad Gita, he basically talks about how he wrote the Bhagavad Gita, and he talks more about his connection with the book, and he talks about how he came to write the book and how it is going to be important for the Krishna consciousness movement. And then Prabhupada, in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita, focuses on the book, and he talks about the five subjects taught in the Bhagavad Gita: Jeevishwara, Kala, Karma, Prakriti. And he explains those five subjects in his introduction. So here, in contrast, Srila Prabhupada, he uses the preface to give what he wants to give. That means that in the preface, he introduces Rupa Goswami to the audience. He introduces the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu briefly. And then he also talks about the concept of Bhakti Rasa. So the book is about Bhakti Rasamrita, is Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So Bhakti Rasa he introduces in the preface. And then in the introduction, largely Srila Prabhupada focuses on the introduction of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu itself. And then he takes some of the verses, he takes the invocation verse and other verses, and he elaborates on those verses. So he also talks about the definition of pure devotional service, which Rupa Goswami has talked about. So the way Prabhupada uses preface and introduction in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is different from the way he uses it in Krishna book. But essentially, we will focus on what Srila Prabhupada is giving in his preface and introduction. Now, Srila Prabhupada called Nectar of Devotion as a summary study. Summary study means that it is, as Srila Prabhupada is giving us a explanation in English language of the intricate concepts that Rupa Goswami brings to bear in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So Srila Prabhupada wrote two books as summary studies. One was the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which he rendered as the Nectar of Devotion, and the second was Krishna book, which he rendered as the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which he rendered as the Krishna book. So Satsarup Maharaj writes in his one of his books appreciating Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was asked, what exactly does a summary study mean? So Prabhupada in a lighter vein said, summary study means I do what I want. So what does it mean, I do what I want? It is not actually Srila Prabhupada is basically pointing out that he doesn't stick to any scholastic conventions, but he basically takes the book and presents it in a way that is relevant to the audience. So in Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada doesn't necessarily stick to the literal flow of the pastime, although he gives the pastime, but Srila Prabhupada buffers the pastime with adequate philosophical contextualization and explanation, so that people who are unfamiliar with Krishna and who can easily misunderstand the pastimes of Krishna get a proper understanding. That's what Srila Prabhupada does through his Krishna book. Now similarly, Nectar of Devotion, when Srila Prabhupada says, I do what I want, that basically means that he doesn't follow the systematic scholarly format which he uses in his Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam, CC. There what does Srila Prabhupada do? He gives the Sanskrit verse, of course that's the way the book is published, but Sanskrit verse and the Roman transliteration and the word-to-word translation, then the sentence translation, and then the purport. So when this is done, it actually requires a huge amount of effort. Now the way Srila Prabhupada wrote his books, it is remarkable, because actually he was traveling so much, and while traveling so much, if one has to write, you know, if you look at the traditionally when the scholars would have to write, they would just stay at one place. There they would have their libraries, and they would sit and research their libraries and write their books. So Srila Prabhupada was constantly traveling. He had some books with him. He had the commentaries of the previous acharyas, and then he would use those. But still, the number of verses that Srila Prabhupada quotes in his purports is remarkable. And many of the places Srila Prabhupada quotes appropriate verses which are not necessarily quoted there by the previous acharyas. So that means Srila Prabhupada is recollecting those verses from his memory, and he's seeing the need to use those verses to explain the particular point over there, and he's quoting them. So Srila Prabhupada's scholarship is itself phenomenal in many ways. And he is the empowered representative of Lord Krishna and Lord Chaitanya in this age. And what we are discussing about here is that the way Srila Prabhupada presented Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam, CC, it's phenomenal, because when he's traveling so much, cannot carry an exhaustive library, and of course we know that he would spend time late at night dictating the purport. So it's remarkable in its own right. Now, but that kind of work requires huge amount of time. And Srila Prabhupada wrote the Krishna book because he felt that because he was quite in an advanced stage, and he was felt that I may not live long enough to actually be able to translate the full Bhagavatam. And because the 10th canto was so important, so he felt that he has to present that for the sake of the world. And therefore he presented that using the summary study format, in which he gave the Krishna book. And we see Srila Prabhupada's foresight, sagacity and wisdom in doing that, because although he kept translating and commenting till the nearly the last breath of his life, but still he had to depart when he was in the 10th canto. So we have the 13th chapter and some sections of the 14th chapter in the 10th canto. And if Srila Prabhupada had not been farsighted enough to give us Krishna book, then we would not have had his assistance in understanding Krishna's pastimes. In fact, it's what the spiritual master gives is not just assistance, spiritual master gives understanding itself. So that is very important. So similarly, Nectar of Devotion is quite a technical book. It's a technical book, and translating it verse by verse is quite a demanding task. So that's why Srila Prabhupada focuses on giving us a summary study. Because this is one of the most important books for the Gaudiya Vaishnavas primarily. Why is it so important? Because in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, there is the special concept of Madhurya Rasa. Of course, Madhurya Rasa, the concept, the principle of the romance of the Lord, the attraction of the Lord between him and his devotees, is in conjugal relationship, that is there as a fact in the Vedic literature, and that is talked about by the other Vaishnava sampradayas also. So for example, there is Shri and there is Vishnu, and there are temples which have the worship of Shri and Vishnu in the Shri sampradaya also. But the intimacy of the relationship in the Madhurya Rasa is very special, as explained in the Gaudiya sampradaya. And this particular sweetness is explained in the Gaudiya Sampradaya through the Bhaktir Sama Sindhu primarily. So if you look at these four books, Ishopanishad, we discussed, is a broadly a Vedic book. Then Bhagavad Gita, the Vedic book means what? It is actually accepted as a authoritative book by all people within the Vedic circle. It is considered, Shankaracharya talked about this Prasthanatray. Actually, the Prasthanatray concept came before him, but he gave it great importance. Prasthanatray means, if one wants to understand Vedanta, one has to have a commentary on three books. These three books are the Vedanta Sutra, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Upanishads. So the Vedanta Sutra is called Nyaya, Bhagavad Gita is called as Smriti, and the Upanishads are the Shruti. So the Ishopanishad, so if we consider this to be like a, consider the four books of the of the Bhakti Shastra to be like a pyramid, then the Ishopanishad is a Vedic book which is accepted by practically in the Vedic schools, all the schools accept this is an important book. Then Bhagavad Gita is also like that. Although Bhagavad Gita is focused on Krishna and in many ways it's a Vaishnava book, but Bhagavad Gita is also accepted by most varieties of people who are followers of the Vedic culture. Now, Nectar of Instruction is a book of general instructions for the followers who want to cultivate bhakti. So, it is a sadhana book, and it is, now if you move it upward, now the special revelations that the world has received through the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, they come in the books which are given by the Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas. So, we are studying in our Bhakti Shastri course two books. One is Upadeshamrit and Bhakti Samrita Sindhu from Rupa Goswami. So Srila Prabhupada translated and commented on the nectar of the Upadeshamrit, calling it a nectar of instruction. This is quite a literal translation. And he gave in his normal way word to word translation and purport. So that book gives practical instructions. Nectar of Devotion also gives practical instructions, but Nectar of Devotion goes deeper into the speciality of Bhakti Rasa as is revealed in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. The word Gaudiya refers to many things. Primarily it refers to Gauda Desha. That Gauda Desha is the area Vishnu Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in the banks of the Ganga River. So that branch of Vaishnavism that appeared in that area. Actually, that's the external meaning. His internal meaning is Gouda is related with the word Gouda. Gouda is jaggery. So, jaggery is Gouda. So, actually, jaggery grows in various parts of the world. But actually, the jaggery that grows in Bengal is specially sweet. It's almost like chocolate. So, Vaishnavism was there in various parts of the world. But the special sweetness of Madhurya Ras, and of all the more so parkiya bhava in Madhuras, that is revealed by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that special sweetness of bhakti comes in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had the Goswami as his primary disciples, and he sent them to Vrindavan with four instructions. He told them that you should go to Vrindavan to excavate the lost sacred places of the pastimes of Radha, of Krishna. And then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself started this by rediscovering Radha Kund, and he asked the Goswamis to do that. Second was, he told them to build temples. So first is that, okay, wherever there have been pastimes, uncover those places. And second is build temples. So the Goswamis, all of them, they had their worshipable deities and Radha Govinda, Radha Madan Mohan, like all these beautiful temples, Radha Damodar, all these temples were built by the Goswamis. A third was to write books establishing how pure devotional service is the conclusion of the teachings of the various scriptures, of the whole Vedic scriptures. It's a vast body, but their conclusion is to establish pure devotion, to teach pure devotion. As Krishna says, Veda ischa sarve raham eva vedyo, that I am to be known. And how is he to be known? He says in 15.15, I am to be known by the Vedas. And then he says in 18.55 that he can be known by Bhaktya Mam Abhijanati, that he can be known by Bhakti. So Bhakti is the conclusion of the Vedic scriptures as far as the sadhana is concerned. What is the sadhana to be followed? By which one can attain the ultimate revelation that is given in the Vedic scripture, that is Krishna. So, Nana Shastra Vicharanaika Nipunam Sadharma Samsthapakau Lokanam Hitakarinau Tribhuvane Sanjeevane. So basically, what is relevant to our context is Nana Shastra Vicharanaika Nipunam. Nipunam means expert. The Goswamis were expert in Nana Shastra Vicharanaika. Vicharanaika means contemplating, considering, analyzing. They analyzed vast body of scriptures. And then Sadharma Samsthapakau, they established the Sadharma. Sadharma is the true religious principle, that is, of bhakti. And for what purpose? Lokanam hitakarinam. For the purpose of doing hit. for the purpose of doing good to all people. Lokanam hitakaya. So this was the mission that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave to the Goswamis, and they executed it. And last was to write books, to exemplify and write books about how a devotee should live. So third and fourth is different. Third is more in terms of Siddhanta, to establish philosophically and scripturally how bhakti is the conclusion of the Vedic literature, and how that is sadharma, and then how to practice that sadharma, exemplify that and teach that to others. So these are the four instructions that were given to the Goswamis. Now, the fact that the Goswamis, especially Rupa and Sanatan, were the primary disciples of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and they were primary in executing his will, that itself indicates the universality of the message of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and of the mood of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, actually Rupa and Sanatan, they were forced to become Muslims, because at that time the Muslim king Dabir Khan, Nawab Hussain Shah, he saw that he wanted to rule and he wanted competent ministers at that time. So he came to know from the people that these two young men, and they were very intelligent and very talented and very competent to be ministers. But in that time, in the Vedic culture, they were Saraswat Brahmanas at that time. They were born in Saraswat Brahman family. It's very cultured. So the culture was such that for a Brahmin to accept the service, for a follower of the Vedic culture to accept the service of a Mlecha, was considered to be like losing the caste. So they didn't want to do this, but then Nawab Hussain Shah threatened that if you don't serve me, that if you don't become a minister for me, then I will persecute the whole Vaishnava community. And in order to protect the Vaishnava community, they did the sacrifice. Of course, they did not sacrifice their bhakti per se. Now, externally they lost their caste, but actually they remained diligent devotees. And where they were staying in Ramakeli, and the king, because he saw that they were competent ministers and he came to rely on them, so he gave them opulence also. So within that, using that opulence, they created for themselves a facility for them to practice bhakti sincerely. And they created almost like a hidden Vrindavan in their own palace, in the gardens, a replica of Vrindavan where they would meditate in the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. So externally they lost their caste, but internally they were completely fixed in devotion. In fact, it was sacrifice, so that sacrifice motivated by their devotion only. And once they had this position of power, they protected Vaishnava culture. In fact, they even not only protected, but they further promoted Vaishnava culture. They would invite Brahmins to their place and they would give charity to the Brahmins, and that's how they would protect and promote the Vedic culture, Vaishnava culture at that time. Now, they corresponded with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu through letters, and eventually Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to meet them. He went out of way in his travels to come to Ramakeli. He blessed them, and then he initiated them. It was not a formal fire initiation, the sacrifice that was performed, but it was in principle the shiksha was given, and then they decided to renounce the world and go to Vrindavan as per the instruction of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So among the two, Rupa Goswami renounced first and Sanatana Goswami renounced later. So because Rupa Goswami renounced first, so Sanatana Goswami considered Rupa Goswami senior, although Sanatana Goswami was the older among the two, but he thought that actually he surrendered his life first. That's why Sanatana Goswami, despite being older, considered himself to be subordinate to Rupa Goswami. And Jiva Goswami, later on when he came to Vrindavan, and he sought initiation from Sanatana Goswami, because he was the older among the two brothers. But Sanatana Goswami said, you go to Rupa Goswami and take initiation from Rupa Goswami. So in that way, they both lived together. So Rupa Goswami was instructed by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally, and those instructions come in the Chaitanya Charitamrita also, in the Madhya Leela. And Sanatana Goswami is also instructed, and both of them, based on the instructions that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave them, they combined those instructions and they wrote many books. So one of the most important books that Rupa Goswami wrote is Bhakti Rasa Amrit Sindhu. And then whatever he talks about general Bhakti Rasa, And especially he talks further about Madhurya Rasa in terms of analysis of various emotions in Madhurya Rasa in his book Ujjwala Neelamani. Sorry, not Ujjwala Neelamani. Yeah, Ujjwala Neelamani. Ujjwala Neelamani is a book which talks of, Neelamani is like a blue jewel. So Ujjwala is effulgent. That means it's a reference to Krishna. Of course, there can be many meanings of it. But this book talks about Madhurya Rasa elaborately. When the gopis, some gopis singing some song in separation from Krishna, then what is the mood at that time? They analyze this indicates this rasa, this indicates this antrasa, this indicates this rasa, like that. So it's a very esoteric and exalted book. And so like that, Rupa Goswami has written many, many books. Actually, we won't go into all his books. We are focusing on Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu's English rendition as Nectar of Devotion. Srila Prabhupada gives this introduction of Rupa Goswami, and then he describes how, if you look at the introduction, then Prabhupada talks about Bhakti Rasa. So let's look at Bhakti Rasa now. Yeah. Srila Prabhupada talks about here about Rupa Goswami, and then Prabhupada writes, what will happen by studying this book? Persons engaged in the Krishna consciousness movement may take advantage of this great literature and be very solidly situated in Krishna consciousness. Be very solidly situated in Krishna consciousness. So we discuss Prabhupada translates bhakti not simply as devotion or divine love, he translated as devotional service. So devotional service is a compound word in which devotion indicates the internal side, the feeling, and the service indicates the acting. So both are there. So devotional service, that's Prabhupada's special translation of bhakti. Now Srila Prabhupada explains how everybody has an impetus to serve, everybody has an impetus to want some pleasure. And we want some kind of pleasure, some kind of rasa, and for that we act in various ways. But the problem with material emotions is that they are temporary. So we may work, and by working we may get some enjoyment. So there is bhoga and there is tyaga. So let's look at this. So Srila Prabhupada talks about how there is, Prabhupada uses the word rasa. We'll not go into technicalities of the word rasa over here. We'll simply talk about rasa in terms of pleasure. That's how Prabhupada uses it, that people get pleasure in various things that they do. So when they get pleasure, there is, this pleasure has two aspects. There is bhoga and there is tyaga. Bhoga means enjoyment and tyaga is renunciation. So sometimes when we enjoy a particular activity, then by enjoying, we feel, oh, I'm enjoying. Initially, when we start enjoying a particular activity, we feel, yes, this is wonderful. I want to do it more and more. We're looking forward to it. Suppose there is a big feast and say my special favorite item is gulab jamun. So then I'm told there's gulab jamun. So I'm very eager for it. And then I'm practically, my mouth is watering, I'm salivating, and then come. And then gulab jamun. And if somebody's serving, when are you going to serve gulab jamun? Come. And then suppose there are unlimited gulab jamuns. You can serve take as much as you want. So I take 1, 2, 3, 5, 10. How much can I take? 15. And then after some time, enough. And not just that I'm full in my stomach, even if my stomach had a lot of capacity, still, you know, the satiation comes. I mean, there are two words, satisfaction and satiation. When I'm satisfied, then I'm happy. But satiated means enough. Now I can't take more. So, you know, over a period of time, if you keep stuffing, then somebody says take more. No, I don't want it. If somebody forces into your mouth, you may even vomit it out. No, why? Because you just can't take it. So material enjoyment, there is bhoga. So there is pleasure initially, but at the end of it, we get frustrated. We get frustrated because it doesn't satisfy us. It doesn't satisfy us. So whatever material enjoyment is there, we can say that there's a law of diminishing returns. Diminishing returns means initially we get a lot of pleasure, but afterward the pleasure keeps decreasing. And then after it goes into negative, we feel frustrated by it. So people enjoy for some time, and after enjoying, then they feel, I can't enjoy anymore, so they want to give it up. Tyaga. So tyaga means renunciation. So one gives it up, one thinks that, okay, I don't want anything to do with this, nothing. sometimes people say drink, somebody drinks alcohol and drinks and afterward they get a hangover. It's just, I'm never going to drink again. Like I give it up. Now, of course, most alcoholics, they have given up alcohol many times and still they are alcoholics. So that tyaga doesn't last for long. But anyway, tyaga is there. So in material life, there is a rasa which we get through enjoyment. And when that rasa doesn't endure, we go to another extreme and try to renounce that. So there is, it's like a pendulum. So one extreme of the pendulum is bhoga, the other extreme of the pendulum is tyaga. So in neither case does the pleasure endure. The pleasure is chapala sukha. Prabhupada uses the word chapala sukha. And this phrase comes from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's song. Chapala sukha labala gire. He says chapala sukha. He says, actually, it's not a song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It's a Vaishnava song. Which is given by other Vaishnava Acharya. So therein he says chapala sukha. I got flickering pleasure. Chapala. That is not permanent. It's temporary pleasure. I got that and went away. It didn't last for long. So fleeting enjoyment. So as compared to this fleeting enjoyment, so there is the rasa that is permanent. That permanent rasa is bhakti rasa. So let's look at this. What Srila Prabhupada is saying over here. How Srila Prabhupada introduce rasa is that force which drives the philanthropist, the householder and the nationalist is called rasa. Or a kind of mellow relationship whose taste is very sweet. So then Prabhupada explains, bhakti rasa is a mellow different from the ordinary rasa enjoyed by mundane workers. Mundane workers, what they enjoy is different. So Prabhupada writes that material engagement means accepting a particular status for some time and then changing it. We don't endure in one situation for a long time, and ultimately there is a death which destroys everything. Even if I say that, oh, I've got job satisfaction, you know, I'm in a material situation which I enjoy, I don't need anything, I'm quite happy in this situation, fine, I may say that I'm happy in this situation, but how long is that situation going to continue? Death is going to take me away with everything. So actually, even while we are alive, the material rasa doesn't endure, and if somebody somehow says no, it will endure, then also it is not going to be endure forever because death is going to take it away. In contrast, bhakti rasa is such that actually it is not taken away by death. We have discussed in the Bhagavad Gita, neha bhikramana shosti pratyavayo navidyate, that whatever we have accumulated by the on the spiritual path, it never goes away from us, it stays forever. There is no loss, there is no diminution, there is no destruction. So bhakti rasa, whatever attraction to Krishna we have cultivated, that will stay forever with us. Discussion 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita also, purva bhyasinti naiva riyate avashopisa, that by past practice one becomes again attracted to Krishna. Riyate avasho, helplessly one becomes attracted. So in this way, this is bhakti. The speciality of bhakti is that it enables us to move straight to, it is something which continues life after life after life. It continues for all of eternity, of course. When you go back to the spiritual world, continuously will go on eternally. But even when we, if you're not purified enough to go back to the spiritual world, even if you're in this world, we go one life at a time after another lifetime, still bhakti will stay with us. No other material position will stay with us. No material position will stay with us for that matter. But bhakti will stay with us forever. So now, Srila Prabhupada further explains how we are preparing for next life by this life. So this eternal engagement in bhakti rasa can be understood by a serious student upon studying the nectar of devotion. So if a student studies the nectar of devotion, Prabhupada says he can understand it. And then the senses can then become uncontaminated, being constantly in touch with the bhakti rasa. When the purified senses are employed in the service of the Lord, one becomes situated in bhakti rasa life. And any action performed for the satisfaction of Krishna in this transcendental bhakti rasa stage of life can be relished perpetually. Relished perpetually. So, what is happening is that in this world, we all want something lasting. What we want is not just lasting possessions, we want lasting emotions. Emotions, not just emotions, any emotion, but pleasant emotions, sweet emotions, emotion of happiness. And many people have the idea that by possession I will get emotion. Yes, if I have a car, if I have a house, If I have this, I have that. Then that possession will bring emotion. What emotion? Emotion of security, emotion of satisfaction. But it doesn't work like that. The possessions themselves don't last, and the emotions don't last also. Actually, the emotions that are there, even when sometimes I have a position, I get, say, a new laptop. Initially, I'm very excited. I have a new laptop. It gives me some emotion. Or it gives me pleasure. It makes me feel special. But after some time, that position may still be there, but the emotion goes away. And after some time, the position also goes away, because it doesn't last forever. So, Bhakti Rasa means that we don't strive for external possessions in the hope that they will bring us emotions, or pleasant emotions. Rather, we focus on the practice of engaging our senses in service of Krishna. And by this engagement in the service of Krishna, the original emotions of the soul, they become awakened. So, the soul has original pure love for Krishna. But that is forgotten, and it is that our love for Krishna, our relationship with Krishna is forgotten, and our emotions, our longing for love is misdirected towards other things now. So there is a redirection of that love towards Krishna, which happens through the process of Bhakti Yoga. So Bhakti and Bhakti Yoga are not the same thing. Bhakti Yoga is the process. Yoga is the process by which one develops Bhakti. So Yoga means connection. So, connecting with the Supreme Lord through Bhakti, that is Bhakti Yoga. And Bhakti is eventually the emotion and the action which is there when we have developed devotion to Krishna. So, that's why our acharyas often use the word Kevala Bhakti, pure devotion. So, Bhakti Yoga is a process which will take us to Kevala Bhakti, to the stage of pure devotion. Now, Srila Prabhupada talks about in the further purport, can we look at it further? The basic principle of the living condition is that we have a propensity to love someone. And then, Prabhupada further says, at the present moment, the human society just wants to love his country, his family, or his personal self, but there is no information where to repose the loving propensity so that everyone can become happy. That missing point is Krishna. Let's try to understand this very profound point. That missing point is Krishna. So what Srila Prabhupada is telling is, all of us have our own loves, different kind of love. You know, say the mother loves the child, the husband and wife may love each other, a patriot loves the country, a philanthropist may love people in general, humanity. There can be different people who love different things, different people also. But all of these are temporary, all of these are limited. Why? So our loving propensity expands. Now, child initially loves oneself only. Child thinks everything in terms of food only. My pleasure. The child can't even think of others and others' pleasure. Child thinks only of one's own pleasure. But as the child grows, start thinking of, he or she starts thinking of others. Okay, my parents are there. Now, I shouldn't just, every time I have a problem, I start crying. And I expect my parents to come and solve my problems, but I have to consider them also. I have to try to please them also. And so then what happens? Instead of thinking of only oneself, the child starts thinking of others. And like that, the child moves from self-centeredness outwards. So there is expansion. Now this expansion is to one's family. That is good. You know, one is not thinking only of oneself, one is thinking of others also. One's family members are thinking. But then that can expand further to say, nation. So for example, somebody might be a patriotic soldier and is ready to risk one's life for the sake of protecting the country. So that is noble. The circle of love has expanded further. And then somebody may go further and think about humanity at large. I will love all human beings. Now in all these cases, the expansion of the loving propensity is good. It is auspicious, it is positive. It is auspicious in the sense that it is, although it is at a material level, but still one is moving from selfishness, concentrated selfishness, one is moving up outwards. But the this is not perfect. None of these is perfect. Because it's not perfect because actually it creates a sort of limitation. When I love my family, then I don't love others. Because others are not part of my family. If I love my country, I don't love other countries. So if I love my countrymen, I'm not loving other countrymen. if I say, even if I love humanity, but still, humanity is not the totality of creation. I may love human beings and I slaughter animals and eat them. So, my love remains incomplete. So, how can our loving propensity become complete? When we love Krishna. Why? How does loving Krishna complete our loving propensity? Because when we learn to love Krishna, at that time, we learn to love the person who is the root of all of existence. So Krishna is not just some historical or mythological person. Krishna is the supreme person. He is the Lord of all living beings. He is Surudam Sarvabhutanam. He is the greatest well-wisher of all living beings. All living beings are his children. That is parts. So when we love Krishna, it is not that we are just loving one person. That person is related with everyone. And by loving Krishna, through Krishna, we learn to love everyone. So, our loving propensity expands to its maximum, Srila Prabhupada would use the word, supermost, to its maximum when we love Krishna. So, if we want a harmony in society, then we loving one particular thing within society will not help. Now, when we love Krishna, through Krishna, we love everyone. And that is the perfection of our loving propensity. So how to love Krishna, that is what Bhaktivinoda Sindhu will teach. And Prabhupada gives the standard examples of when we water the root of the tree, the whole tree gets watered, and when we put food in the stomach, all the parts of the body get nourished. So then Prabhupada says that unless one has realized Krishna, there is no question of self-realization. So Prabhupada says that one doesn't have to cultivate Atma-gyan separately. If one just cultivates love for Krishna, then it is like the sun rising. When the sun rises, I can see myself clearly. I can see my own hand in front of me. Without the sun, I can't see my own hand. So like that, when we understand Krishna, Krishna is the supreme sun. And by knowing him, we will come to know about ourselves also. So in bhakti, we don't try to cultivate Atma-gyan separately. We focus on pure devotion, we focus on developing our devotion towards Krishna, and Atma-gyan comes automatically. So now, let's go to the introduction. So in the introduction, let's look at a few things first. So this is what we have discussed till now. The history of the book, the history of the author, and primary subject matter, Bhakti Rasa. This is what was discussed in the preface. And then we discussed about comparison of characters of material rasa, this Bhogatyaga and Chapala Sukha. So actually Bhakti Rasa is the soul has a natural love for Krishna. So it's the natural position of the soul. And it's perpetual. Once we get situated in bhakti, we get rasa constantly. And it's not only perpetual in terms of this lifetime, it is eternal. Now we are going to the introduction. So introduction. First, there is Mangalacharan. Mangalacharan is the invocation of auspiciousness. We'll just look at what Mangalacharan means. Then there is Prabhupada gives a broad overview of the contents and scope of the book. Then he focuses on the definition of pure devotional service, and he explains that definition. So let's look at the... Now Srila Prabhupada explains, based on what Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says Chaitanya Charitamrita, and in general it is understanding. What is the purpose of Mangalacharan? It has three purposes. So, it states the objective of the book. It offers pays obeisances to the worshipable deity. And then there is a benediction offered. Benediction is Falashruti for those who are reading. So like that, Mangalacharan serves multiple purposes. Mangalacharan is invoking auspiciousness. So now, Srila Prabhupada talks about, so Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami talks about it, and Prabhupada mentioned this also. So now we are coming to the Mangalacharan of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. What is that Mangalacharan? So he says over here, Akhila Rasamrita Murti Prashram Ruchiruddhataraka Pali Kalita Shyamo Lito Radha Prayan Vidhur Jayati Jayati. Let that Lord be glorified. Who is that Lord? His glories are supreme. Krishna, the destroyer of all sins and the bestower of all bliss. The very form of the highest bliss. Akhila Rasamrita Murti. filled with rasas, Rasamrit Murti, excels all others in joy. And he brings Taraka and Palika under his control by the diffusion of his beauty. And he accepts Shyamala and Lalita as his equals and gives pleasure to Radha by his excellent qualities. So here, the Bhaktirasamrita Sangamrita talks about quite an extraordinary thing. It's talking about for the invocation when the Mangalacharan is being offered. To, what is it being? It's offered to Krishna. Now, but what Krishna in what mood? You know, studying the Bhagavad Gita, we were reciting this verse: Prapanna Parjataya Totravetraika Panaya Jnana Mudraya Krishnaya Gita Amrita Duhe Nama. This is a prayer to Krishna. But what is the mood of Krishna over here? We are focusing on Krishna as the giver of the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita. We are offering obeisance to that Krishna. But here the Krishna who is being invoked is not Krishna of Kurukshetra or not Krishna of Dwarka, not the Krishna of the Pandava of Hastinapur who is helping the Pandavas. It is the Krishna of Vrindavan. And not just the Krishna of Vrindavan, it is the Krishna of Vrindavan, of Madhurya Rasa in Vrindavan. So it is that Krishna that is being called. And Srila Prabhupada doesn't focus on the specifics of the various gopis. Now he basically is relishing Madhurya Rasa with his gopis. So Prabhupada doesn't focus on that. The focus is on Akhil Rasamrita Murtihi. Akhil Murti. Murti means form. Akhil Rasamrita. Akhil Rasamrita. Completely filled with rasa. So Krishna is the reservoir of rasa. He is the embodiment of rasa. He is the personification of rasa. When we say embodiment or personification, that is not in the metaphorical sense. It is actually Krishna is filled with rasa. He is nothing but rasa. So, and this rasa is what attracts the devotees, the gopis in Madhurya Rasa, in conjugal mellow. And it's what attracts all living beings. So what Rupa Goswami through this invocation is telling us is that O Krishna, I am writing this book about the Bhakti Rasa, and you are the object of this book. You are the reservoir of all rasa. You are Akhila Rasa Amrit Murti, you are the form of all rasas. And therefore it is to you I offer my obeisances. So actually, there if we go back to the three objectives, it is to of three aspects of Mangalacharan, it is tell the objective. So objective is to reveal, glorify this Akhil Rasa Amrit Sindhu. And implied in this is, what is the, he's offering obeisances, Jayati, I offer obeisances to this Lord. And then what is the blessing that is offered? Implicit blessing, it is not an explicit blessing over here. The implicit blessing is that, herein it is there and it comes later also, but it is that just as the gopis are attracted to Krishna, who is Akhil Rasa Amrit Murti, similarly, all of us can also become attracted to Krishna. May all those who read this book, may they also become attracted to Krishna. This is Akhil Rasa Amrit Murti. And then, so now, let's move forward. So here we will see that Akhil Rasa Amrit Murti. So His Holiness Bhanu Maharaj has translated the Durgam Sangamani Tika. That is the commentary on the Bhaktirasam Sindhu by Jiva Goswami. And therein he explains what is this Akhila Samrit Murti, he elaborates on this. Unique feature which is the cause of all the qualities is his form of supreme bliss, Amrita Murti. Since he contains all the 12 rasas, Akhil Rasa, starting with Shanta. So we'll discuss about these 12 rasas when we come to it more. But so what is the speciality of Krishna who is being invoked over here? He is, so Akhil Rasa Amrita Murti. Akhil Rasa means all 12 rasas are there. Amrita Murti. Amrita Murti means the supreme bliss. The form of supreme bliss. So Amrit can mean nectar. Amrit can mean happiness. The form of supreme bliss. That is Krishna. So this is the sweet vision of Krishna that is being invoked by Srila Rupa Goswami when he is starting the Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. And then he goes on and there are several verses which come up. So one of the important verses here which comes up is this. I offer my respects to the devotees who are like Makaras, kings among fishes, frolicking in the sweet ocean of devotional rasa, who disregard the insignificant rivers of liberation and who are free from fear caused by the net of time. This is a complex and sweet metaphor. Srila Prabhupada used it partially in his purport, in his summary study also. So what is it actually telling? It's telling that there are several important points talked over here. So first point is that often the impersonalists talk about merging into the Supreme Lord. They talk about how we, just as the river goes into the ocean and merges into the ocean, similarly the jiva goes and merges into the Supreme Lord. That's the idea. So countering that, Rupa Goswami says that actually the soul doesn't merge into the Supreme Lord. Rather, just like even in the ocean, there are aquatics, and the aquatics sport and delight in the ocean. So similarly, we sport and delight in the ocean. So we means the pure, we the souls, when they become purified and develop pure devotion to Krishna. So there are pure devotees who delight in the ocean. So he's comparing the pure devotees to the makaras, to the fish, to the aquatics. So through this example, he's countering the idea of impersonal merging. So there is the Supreme Lord, and the Supreme Lord and the devotees, they all rejoice in the ocean of devotion. So there is the ocean of material existence. We want to come out of the ocean of material existence, but after coming out of the ocean of material existence, what do we want to do? We want to go to the ocean of devotion, and we want to swim in that ocean of devotion and rejoice in that ocean of devotion. That's what is indicated through this first part. And then what is the characteristics of these devotees? So he offers obeisances to the Supreme Lord, he offers obeisances to others also, and then he offers obeisances to the devotees in general, who disregard the insignificant rivers of liberation. And what does it mean, rivers of liberation? He's talking about a different analogy. He's not, this is not the same analogy, river merging into the ocean. This is slightly different. He's saying that as compared to a ocean, the river contains very less water. In its own sense, the river may have a lot of water, but as compared to the ocean, the amount of water in the river is very, very tiny. So like that, actually the amount of pleasure through liberation is very finite, is very limited. We will discuss this later on when moksha laguta akrita, that the pleasure of liberation is made insignificant by the as compared to the pleasure of devotion. So Brahmanand becomes insignificant as compared to Bhaktianand. So same point he is taking over here, that they consider the liberation is like a river, whereas devotion is like an ocean. So as compared to an ocean, a river is insignificant. Similarly, as compared to Bhaktianand, the happiness of liberation is insignificant. And then, who are free from fear caused by the net of time. So again, he's taking another metaphor, that there is there may be fish, aquatics in an ocean, and there some people may come and some fisher people may come and they throw their net, and the aquatics are happily sporting in the ocean, but suddenly they get caught and they get trapped. So they get trapped, but then what happens? He's saying that actually the devotees are so deep in the ocean that no net can trap them. And what is the net he's comparing it to? It's time. So in somebody may say that actually this Bhavasagar, you say it's a place of misery. No, I'm enjoying this. I'm wealthy, I'm young, I'm powerful, I can enjoy. But then all of us, if we think that we are going to enjoy over here, the net of time is going to be there. And it's going to catch us and trap us, and then we will be slaughtered at the time of death. So as compared to this, in the ocean of devotion, the net of time cannot reach. You know, in the Brahma Samhita, it said, "Mesha ardhaka varajati yatra api samaya," that even as much time as is required for blinking an eyelid, that much time also doesn't pass in the spiritual world. That there's eternal present. Now that does not mean there is no time in the spiritual world. There is time, but time does not control or destroy. What makes time fearsome in this world is that it controls and it destroys. In the spiritual world, time neither controls nor it destroys. So in that sense, in the spiritual world, time is there, but it simply adds to the rasa. So the time we get controlled and destroyed, that is not there, and that's what is being referred to over here when it is said that they are beyond the net of time. And then Srila Prabhupada explains further how just like the ocean can have different parts, eastern part, western part, northern part, southern part. So like that, Srila Prabhupada said there are different, in the eastern ocean, which is what is going to be discussed, the varieties of bhakti, in verse chapter 19 we'll be discussing this. So there is the Bhakti Samrit Sindhu, the heading is Samanya Bhakti, so that is like an overview of devotional service, that's introduction in chapter 1. And then there is Sadhana Bhakti, which is talked about. Sadhana Bhakti will have two parts, Vaidhi Bhakti and Raghavanubha Bhakti, that is devotional service and practice, that is chapters 2 to 16. And then there is Bhava Bhakti, that is devotional service in ecstasy, that is chapter 17 and 18. And then there is Prema Bhakti, that is devotional service in love of God, that is chapter 19. So this is the overview of what is being discussed in the Bhakti Shastri course. So Samanya, we will be discussing these four aspects in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. In its eastern ocean we'll be discussing. Then now let's look at, while talking about the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, one of the most important verses in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is this definition of pure devotional service. Srila Prabhupada calls it Anyabhilashita Shunyam Jnana Karmadi Anavritam. Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhaktiruttama. Let's come back to this now. So Anyabhilashita Shunyam. This is an important verse. And let's try to understand this properly. Anya Abhilashita. There are other aspirations. Shunyam. Shunyam means zero. The important point is, the Mayavadis say that ultimately all emotions have to become zero. Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha. It is said in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra that give up all movement of consciousness, all emotions. But no, here he is saying Anya Abhilashita. There's one Abhilasha which should continue. That is the desire to love Krishna, to serve Krishna, that should continue. And apart from that, everything else should be given up. And it's not just Abhilasha, it is Abhilashita. Because sometimes, when a devotee is in danger, a devotee may pray to Krishna for help. And a devotee may pray to Krishna for protection at a material level also. In Draupadi, she is being disrobed, she prays to Krishna for protection. So now, that is not a fault in devotional service. And when there is extreme sudden danger, a devotee may pray to Krishna for protection. But normally a devotee, so that is, that an occasional abhilasha may come, a desire may come, but abhilashita means a tendency. So the devotee does not have a tendency to seek protection at a material level. A devotee seeks simply to serve Krishna and to love, express the love for Krishna thereof. So anya abhilashita shunyam. So all other tendencies are shunya, they are made zero. But that does not, so that means the heart's desire, heart's nature, heart's tendency is primarily to love and serve Krishna, nothing else. And how is this expressed? That does not mean that we give up everything. Jnana karma adi anavritam. Jnana karma adi. So that means jnana and karma, that is the knowing faculty and the acting faculty, we don't give them up. Anavritam. Avritam. Avritam means covered. So actually our, the soul in the pure spiritual state has pure jnana and pure karma. So that is different from the jnana yoga, karma yoga, or jnana and karma that is talked about in this world. So in the spiritual world, the soul knows Krishna and the soul works to please Krishna. So when the soul is covered over by the gross and subtle bodies, is covered over by the conditionings, then that jnana and karma are directed towards other things, towards material enjoyment or towards liberation. But jnana karma adi anavritam. They become uncovered. They become uncovered. That's what happens by the practice of bhakti yoga. So, or rather, sadhana bhakti involves that one doesn't give up jnana and karma, but one actually does jnana and karma for the sake of Krishna. So, the covering which causes misdirection of jnana and karma, that is given up. And then the pure jnana and pure karma are invoked. So, it's not jnana karma adi shunyam. It is jnana karma adi anavritam. So the soul does act and soul knows in the spiritual world, in pure love for Krishna, but then it is not misdirected or covered or distorted by anything. And then anukulyena, So the important point is that a devotee is always favorably disposed towards Krishna. Now Kamsa was also constantly thinking of Krishna. And Kamsa, when he fought with Krishna also, or rather when the Asuras fight with Krishna, they give pleasure to Krishna. But they are Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha. They also, you know, when there was a fight between Narasimha Deva and Hiranyakashipu, the Lord got Virya Ras in that. The God got the joy of fighting. But their intention was not to please Krishna. That's why that is not considered a bhakti. So a devotee should want to please Krishna. A devotee should be favorably disposed toward Krishna. Anukulyena Krishna. And then Anushilanam. Anushilanam is bhakti is first and foremost a cultivation. So this we have discussed elaborately in Nectar of Instruction. We will not go over here. Bhakti is not just a emotion, a sentiment. It's a cultivation. You know, there are systematic activities that we do, and through those activities the emotion of devotion becomes systematically cultivated. And this is Bhaktir Uttama. This is pure devotion, top class devotion. We'll continue the discussion in our next class. Thank you. Hare Krishna.